Hello and welcome to edition 371 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Tom Edwards.
On the show today, we'll be looking at the world of politics and the grease in the gears that keeps the show rolling. Political journalist Ben Wright will be discussing his book, Order, Order, The Rise and Fall of Political Drinking.
Then we're off to the gallery, but none like you've seen before. Artist, designer and inventor Dominic Wilcox will be talking us through a new exhibition designed specifically for dogs. He'll be with us a little later on.
And we'll be looking at the film talent of Argentina with Sofia Serban de Scalón, director of London's Argentine Film Festival. She'll be with us at the end of the show.
That's all coming up. Plus Monocle's Henry Rees-Sheridan will be here to premiere an exclusive trailer over the next 7 days in Current Affairs. Don't splash out on popcorn for that one. And plus we'll be spinning some new music too. Do people still spin things? Well, we're going to try. Right here on the Monocle Weekly. That's on Monocle 24.
Another week bites the dust, Andrew, and we're talking dog art, amongst other things, and drinking. Several things that I'm particularly interested in, I must be honest.
And I've got a dog, so I like dogs too.
Exactly.
I'm going to take the... Well, we'll hear how the exhibition's actually like, but I'm keen to take my dog along to the dog art exhibition.
And what about... We're talking about political... The sort of dying art of political drinking as well.
Do I like a drink?
Later in the show, I was going to ask. No, but it is interesting.
You can't tell by my red nose.
Well, it's only because it's just afternoon on Sunday, so... I would still say that's a perfectly acceptable drinking hour, is it not?
It's fine. My gouty leg up here on the on the stool. I think we're going to cope fine.
Perfect.
Well, should we get Henry Rees-Sheridan?
Yeah, let's find out what's happening in next week's News Today. Henry, oh Henry, love the way you jump and rock. All right. So, Monocle's Henry Rees-Sheridan is indeed here, Andrew. Kicking off with next week's news today. Henry, where shall we start?
Let's begin in France, Tom. The former French President Nicolas Sarkozy, Sarko, is expected to announce his 2017 candidacy bid on the 20th of August. He wants to become the presidential nominee of Les Républicains. Now, this is... interesting, I think, for several reasons. Number one, he said that he was going to retire from politics in 2012, but it looks like we've got a little comeback tour coming up. Number two, he is actually currently profiting from I wouldn't call it a surge in popularity, but there's some momentum behind him in terms of the public opinion.
Well, you get this thing, don't you, where the previous incumbent, almost by dint of leaving office... people look back with rose-tinted spectacles. Because he was not a popular president.
He wasn't, but he's also availed himself of the... maybe not availed himself, but, you know, the public mood is strange in France at the moment in light of the terror attacks, the extraordinary state of emergency that the country's been in for the better part of the last year. And he seems to have capitalised on that or been able to seize the mood of the nation in a way that very few other French politicians have. Hollande hasn't done badly.
He's done pretty badly.
He's done
his popularity at 11%. That's pretty bad.
That's bad. I retract my remarks. But it is also true that, like, you know, he's still...
It's lower than yours, Henry, that's for sure.
And that's low, as you know.
No, yours is very high.
So, you know, we could be seeing...
You're up there with Vladimir Putin, I think.
Oh, fantastic.
Like 98%, I think.
Brilliant.
That's solid. It's pretty solid.
And, you know, obviously the person who wins this nomination is likely to be the next French president, so we could be seeing a comeback of
a
major
variety. But is it a poison chalice, though? This is, I guess, one of the key questions. You know, who wants to be taking on... the job at the moment? France is wrestling with so many problems of, you know, an internal and an international nature.
I think if you're of Sarkozy's disposition...
definitely him.
Yeah, I think...
Maybe it could be like those kind of old rock stars. We could have, like, Berlusconi back in Italy, you know, back in London. Yeah.
A supergroup, is that what you're proposing?
Yeah. Like the PM supergroup.
The Rolling Stones tour, where they're
still
going.
They come back after you thought they were dead.
Imagine that.
Zimmer frame 2020.
Yeah, that'd be extraordinary. So yeah, we could be. I mean, I'm not sure what.
Do
the
you
chances
have that?
Of,
is that power within your gift, Henry?
What,
probably not.
Excuse me.
To restore all the former leaders to their
well,
roles.
Single-handedly.
I don't know.
I should hope not. This is given that I hope we're living in functioning democracies.
The news look ahead is that it's a special role. I know this very well personally. So,
should we move on?
Probably best.
On the 15th of August, Liechtenstein is going to be celebrating its anniversary of independence. It severed its ties with the German Confederation in 1866. It also marks the anniversary of Prince Alois taking office as regent of Liechtenstein on the 15th of August 2004. Now, Liechtenstein, I like these small kind of...
Like a small state?
Micronations within Europe. I think they're interesting politically.
You got a favourite? Liechtenstein would be it, would it?
It has been Liechtenstein. I'll tell you why. I interviewed Hans-Jürgen Guritz, the architect.
Are you yodeling as you say that, or is that...
That is, I believe, the correct pronunciation.
Okay,
I'm almost
well
certainly wrong.
No.
Now, he built the extraordinary parliament building in Vaduz. I think we featured it in the magazine.
It's also in the How to Make a Nations book. Buy your copy today, because it's interesting.
By Steve Bloomfield. Yeah. Do you want to talk about that, Andrew?
Well, no, it's, what's good is it's small and perfectly formed. Obviously, they don't have so many members of parliament. I think there's only some 20, 30,000 proper Liechtensteiners, I think that's what they're called, and they commissioned a building that's timber, that's very alpine, that's a circular kind of meeting room. It feels like business is going to get done swiftly in a nice kind of council-y kind of way. So the architecture is good for the state, and also there's something about the timber makes it seem very kind of cozy nation. Whereas in fact we know that for like the past two or three decades there've been lots of questions about banking secrecy and how the country was making its money. And I think this is kind of like quite a fresh-faced, open kind of institution, which helps you think that the country has changed or will change or wants to be seen in a more intriguing light. You know, they certainly didn't build a bunker and kind of do their banking business in it.
Well, one thing that I found interesting when I was speaking to him is that, you know, obviously he took into account the symbolic requirements of building a parliament building, but the way he spoke about it, it was almost as if he was taking a similar approach to it, as if he was designing an office for a new kind of quite dynamic company. He was saying that, you know, the chairs need to be comfortable, there need to be meeting rooms, because all of the parliamentarians have day jobs. They meet on the weekends and in the evenings, and they need to get things done. And that was, you know, in stark contrast to, for example, Westminster, which is a kind of insane anachronism in terms of its physical layout with these...
Well, a very austere and, yeah, maybe
well, it's
not... Well,
it's deliberately too small.
Speaking of comparing Vaduz and London or Westminster...
Go on.
Is it Liechtenstein that has the same tune of their national anthem as the UK?
Well, that's a pub question. I don't know.
Well, I'm throwing it out there.
I don't know.
If you know, do write in. Probably to Henry, not to me.
Please do. hrsandmonocle.com. And should we move on?
I'm
losing track of time. Go on.
I want to know what Andrew's favourite European micronation was.
Well, I've been to a few of them. I've been to Vaduz, and I've also been to San Marino, which this was a few years ago, and they seem to make most of their money from having the main street was lined with hundreds and hundreds of off licenses. Because some years ago, this is a few years ago, they weren't quite covered by all of the kind of trade laws, I think. So they had lots of like knockoff drinks and alcohol like brands, and they seem to be it seemed to be one giant off license. Which I quite think
which is quite good
for a nation.
That's
I think
a good soft power expression if ever I heard one.
Yeah, excellent.
Okay, well,
I've been to Monaco. I've never been to Andorra.
Okay, well, maybe you need to chalk them all off before you can finally give a definitive
vote. I know, I've been to Paradise and I've seen some things that a woman ain't meant to see.
Wowee. And on that note,
have you been undressed by kings?
I can't say not to my knowledge, Andrew.
back to you, Henry.
On that note, from the 15th,
is that a note?
I'm gonna chalk it up as note. From the 15th to the 17th of August, it is the 47th anniversary of the Woodstock Music Festival. Tom, you of course were there.
Whoa,
I wonder,
that's unfair.
If you can,
in spirit maybe. What are my memories?
Woodstock, obviously, what it says here, generally regarded as the last major event of the hippie era.
But you know what they say about it?
Go on.
If you can remember it, then you weren't there. So,
and it's always confusing, because whenever you go down to, you head out west and you're going down past Blenheim Palace on that highway.
Woodstock.
And there's a village called Woodstock. And when I was young, I can't remember.
What was all the fuss about?
Yeah, I was like, what they had like maypole dancing on the village green? What was that festival then? So anyway, it turns out more than one Woodstock in the world.
Yeah, I think it's quite a popular place name. Interesting, at the time, it held the record of the largest music audience in the world. Although, by the time the most famous act came on stage,
Jimi Hendrix,
it in fact dwindled from 500,000 to maybe considerably less than 200,000.
And you know why that was? I think it was because he refused to play before whoever was headlining on the whatever it was, the Saturday or Sunday night, because he wanted to be the true headliner and play last, but everyone had shipped off back to the city. But apparently still delivered one of the, you know, the seminal rock performances.
I've got the VHS if you want to borrow it, Tom.
Where did you get that from?
HMV in Swansea.
Oh, not some Vedder's knockoff shop. That's what I thought you
meant. No.
Interesting. Is that being marked in any particular way, the Woodstock anniversary? Not as far as you're aware.
No, it doesn't say here.
We should probably mark it all in our own particular
way. They're probably only just picking up the final litter, aren't they?
Yeah, they're
really spaced that guy, long hair, still there wandering.
Yeah, that's it.
That's the news next week.
Happy to discuss anything else you want to, guys?
I think that's all good,
Henry.
Good?
That was pretty good. I think that was a classic combo of light and shade, as always. Henry, Rhys, Sheridan, thanks for bringing us next week's news today.
Broadcasting globally from London, 24 hours a day, this is Monocle 24.
From London, de Paris,
to Munich,
tot Montreal, Singapore,
para Istanbul,
из Midori House в Лондоне, вы слушаете Monocle 24.
And to Testameona in the Monocle 24.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Our first discussion today is about alcohol and politics. Journalist and writer Ben Wright is the author of Order, Order, The Rise and Fall of Political Drinking.
It's a book that looks at how many of history's most significant political events perhaps might not have happened in exactly the same way without a clink of glasses and some high spirits to grease the gears. And Ben is rather well positioned to write about it. He's a political correspondent for the BBC and as such has covered everything from general elections to presidential visits. And he joins us now to tell us more. Ben, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Great to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Now, we should say, there's lots of entertaining stories and anecdotes, of course, in this book, almost by definition. But then there is something rather more serious about drinking, certainly drinking to excess. Is this a funny book about a potentially serious topic, or is it maybe the other way around?
I think I wrote it as a social history of politics. I realised that drink would be quite a good thread to tell a political history. The spur for doing it was actually Tony Blair's biography when he produced that 4 or 5 years ago. And in there, he talked about his own drinking when he was in Number 10. And he agonises about how much he was drinking. He consumed more the longer he was there. I think by the end, he was having a gin and tonic and half a bottle of wine with his dinner. And he was fretting that this was too much to the complete incredulous reaction of Scottish MPs who thought this was just a pathetic amount to be worrying about. And you start to think about drink, and there are wonderful big characters with funny stories to tell, scrapes they've got into, and drink is something that we all relate to. But the difficulty of doing it, or the part of the story I had to be aware of, is that it wouldn't be right just to tell a humorous tale of drink. It has to acknowledge that drink can also lead to alcoholism, which is a terrible disease, and kills people. And of course, Charles Kennedy, in my time at Westminster, the most recent prominent example of that.
Well, we've put the health warning on, but now
that's all I was doing.
But now, Tom, I think we can talk about some of the characters, because you forget until you crack open your book how many amazing people there were have gone through Parliament. Wild characters, the likes of Alan Clark, for example, who didn't ever shy away from having a drink. But has the culture at Westminster, for example, really changed in recent years? And have some of those characters managed to cling on?
There certainly are wild characters in this book. Alan Clark, a contemporary rake. But go back to Georgian England, people like Francis Dashwood, one of the most prominent Georgian politicians of his era. I mean, he revived the whole Hellfire Club scene. And he and the cabinet and the prime minister at the time would disappear to an abbey on the outskirts of London, drink extraordinary amounts in strange rituals and have orgies. I mean, that has stopped, I can tell you, with some certainty.
For the most part, surely only.
And Alan Clark, I think, was the last of the most prominent bon viveurs, actually, who was happy to drink and seen to drink. That has tailed off a bit, I think, as politics has sobered up, become more serious, become more technocratic. And I think one of the main reasons why sort of the public celebratory drinking that previous generations of politicians were happy to indulge in is that now we're just more censorious. And I think Twitter, 24-hour media, it would not be forgiving of a politician who is seen to enjoy life, I don't think, like Alan Clark did.
Except if you're Nigel Farage. Now, how has he... So, for our listeners around the world, Nigel Farage leads UKIP, and if you haven't heard of that, it's a party on the right, a character who campaigned for us to leave the EU, and he likes to be shot holding a pint of beer. Now, most politicians, when they see a camera coming, they hide their glass, and they certainly don't want to be photographed drinking. He's exactly the opposite. How has he managed to be that person who everyone respects a bit more because he does like a few drinks?
It's a key part of his appeal, as you rightly say, and I think it's a mark of his authenticity. And I think it has helped him because it looks like he's sort of sticking two fingers up to the political establishment. He doesn't care about the rules. He's not interested in political correctness. And he knows when most politicians during the course of an election will do the classic electoral photo opportunity, standing behind a bar, having badly pulled a pint and then holding it up for the cameras. It doesn't look authentic at all. Whereas Farage has always been a huge drinker, and he's happy for everyone to know he's a huge drinker. And I think that wins him points when it comes to authenticity. And it's certainly not a political affectation. I mean, he has been drinking very, very heavily for years. He's one of the politicians. I interviewed a lot of politicians for this book, and I've drunk with Nigel Farage before. For the book, I just had a cup of coffee. But he shared some of his drinking secrets. One of them is that he said he had a firm rule when it came to mixing work and drink. He said he'd never do a live interview if he'd had more than 5 pints.
that's an impressive line in the sand, line in the sand to draw. It's interesting though, Ben, obviously you mentioned already a couple of the examples, and we go back through history. Winston Churchill, of course, committed drinking. He was derided by, you know, the Germans during the war and painted as a sort of an alcoholic, loved his Paul Roger in the evening. Traditionally, did great drinkers make good politicians, or did politics drive men to drink and women to drink?
That's a good question. Certainly, as far as Churchill's concerned, I think it seems to be a key part of his self-medication, actually. I mean, I think by any contemporary measure, he was probably dependent on alcohol, but he used it to manage his own mood swings, and it gave him energy, certainly. And there's no evidence that it actually affected his performance in the job. Even though he was prime minister at the moment of, you know, most epic crisis for the country, and consuming amounts now that just seem absolutely extraordinary. He really would have a glass of wine or two for breakfast and then sip whiskey and soda during the day and then have a colossal dinner with wine and champagne topped off with brandy. And yet there's no evidence that he was ever drunk or incapable of doing the job. It did not harm him or his reputation at all. Others, though, it did. Asquith, for instance, the British Prime Minister at the beginning of the First World War, he certainly had a reputation as a party goer, you know, a lover of Edwardian society in London, a good drinker. But as the First World War began, that caused him a lot of difficulty, and the music halls of London started to resound to the sounds of songs mocking him and his love of a drink and his love of a good time. And that's what's interesting about politics and alcohol. Just as you pick out Nigel Farage as an exception, some political drinkers are celebrated and we look back very fondly at them and we admire their capacity to drink while doing the jobs. Others are excoriated for their drinking. And then, of course, there are the casualties that we've mentioned too. So people are judged on their drinking in quite different ways.
We were going to talk about Margaret Thatcher. Now, Margaret Thatcher wasn't she was seen with a glass of sherry. She was seen doing the classic pulling of the pint as well, but was not really a heavy drinker in public. But her husband had a reputation for liking a glass or two. And I know in the book you have an amazing list of his kind of his diet, as it were.
Yes, I mean Mrs. Thatcher, you're right, was not an excessive drinker by any means, but like most prime ministers, did enjoy a drink. And certainly for her, I've been told by people who worked with her, that a glass of whiskey in the evening was a really important transition between the working day and the red boxes and the downtime of an evening. She found it very hard to relax, but the drink helped her, as it did most politicians. But you're right, her husband Dennis, a proper bon viveur, he spent his time when she was a number 10 on the golf courses, in the bars. He loved a drink. And I interviewed Bernard Ingham for the book, who was Mrs. Thatcher's press secretary for many years and spent a lot of time travelling with them, and was able to compile Dennis Thatcher's list of drinks in order of alcoholic potency. And I'll just rattle through them now. Broadly speaking, it went like this. First of all, there was an opener. That's the first one. Then a brightener, a lifter, a tincture, a large gin and tonic without the tonic, a snifter, a snort, a snorter and a snorterino, which I'm told more or less emptied the bottle in one go. Dennis did certainly enjoy himself.
It's a wonderful. It didn't have a sharpener in there, which is always one of my personal favourites. I just wonder, you know, people talk about alcohol broadly and they say, look, it's often described as a social lubricant. You know, it's very good for getting to know people. It's very good for getting to actually cutting to the heart of what might be rather delicate discussions. Is politics in some way, as we get more politically correct and less inclined to show our true selves to people, the political classes I'm talking about, does politics maybe lose something if people don't, you know, let their guard down, enjoy a drink? You know, are there great, maybe some great political unions that maybe we never would have been struck if it were not over a pint or ten?
I think that's right. And most people I spoke to for this book thought, on the whole, the role of drink was good for politics. You know, it does grease conversation. It's a shortcut to camaraderie. It perks you up when you're celebrating. It consoles you when you're down. You know, that is the life of politics in a nutshell. All those experiences are felt. And I think certainly now, as a political journalist, going out for lunch with a politician, which traditionally has been a bit of a transaction conducted over food with wine to help, suddenly loosen up the process. They're stiffer affairs now. They're not as enjoyable. They're drier. They're less useful, often because there isn't that little ingredient, a drink, to help it along.
You think your job's probably actually got more difficult?
I think most political journalists...
as politicians become more lucid.
There are a number of reasons. I mean, the political parties, number 10, have become more controlling. Special advisors turn up now. When you meet a minister for lunch, the whole thing is more controlled. And I think the absence of a drink is a factor in that too. And it's rare to go out with a senior politician now and to split a bottle. Now it's still and sparkling. It's not red or white. So yes, I think politics probably has suffered a bit. And people who bemoan the professionalisation of politics, as you said, would point to the declining presence of drink as evidence of that, and would regret it. Others would say this is a terrific thing. You know, why on earth should politicians have the freedom to drink on the job when nobody else can?
Well, I guess one of the other interesting things is, I guess it's a reflection of the nature of how politics has changed. You know, there are more women in politics, thank goodness. There are more people who want to go home to their kids at the end of the day and don't want to be sitting around kind of in a pub near the House of Commons at kind of midnight. And do you think that actually the drinking culture was in a way a kind of a men's club thing, and it was by its nature going to change once the world became a little bit more equal?
Yes, I mean, it was definitely, and most of this story is a story of men drinking with men in no matter which country I'm looking at. And certainly the years when Parliament would just be awash with drink through the evening, and you would find members of Parliament staggering back to the chamber for a late vote, midnight, the early hours. That's gone for a number of reasons, primarily a change in the hours. It happened when Labour won in 1997 and they introduced something that looked like more normal working hours to the House of Commons. But there was suddenly a large influx of women. That made a difference too. For them, this culture was something which they didn't feel comfortable with, didn't want to be part of. And that definitely changed the environment within the House of Commons. And there was also an awareness of the health damage that excessive drinking was doing, that within the last 10, 15 years has certainly taken the edge off the drinking. But there are certainly an older generation of politicians that mourns the fact that those bars now, which used to have very identifiable characters too, you know, you had the Strangers Bar known as the Kremlin, would be full of Labour MPs drinking through the night. You'd have the Smoking Room, the heart of the Tory party, packed every night. That's all gone.
Tell me, your book isn't just about the UK. You go around the world and you go to countries where the drinking culture is different in various ways. You look at Yeltsin in Russia. You look at some of the presidents in America during periods when, you know, it was illegal to drink. What did you find there about how people have coped with or not coped with politics and booze?
There's always been a sort of a hypocrisy when it comes to politicians and their drinking, as we've been discussing, ways that they behave in public as opposed to how they behave in private. And during Prohibition, great efforts were made, these bootleggers, making sure that alcohol continued to flow into Congress and congressmen would continue to get their hands on often very, very ropey booze while banning the rest of the country. But it does. It does flow through the story of American politics too. And I spoke to Haley Barbour, who was the former chair of the Republican National Committee, the governor of Mississippi, a proud bourbon drinker, knows Capitol Hill very well. And he certainly mourned the fact now that the days when Republicans and Democrats would drink together in a senator's room of an evening had gone. And look, it's not the only reason that Washington is as polarized as it is now, but he thought it was a symptom of it. It was part of the reason why politics in America is perhaps so confrontational, because the drinking has stopped among politicians.
Ben, I just wondered, finally, maybe, what about the great decisions or bad decisions maybe that are attributable to booze? I'm sure everyone in their personal experience has plenty they can probably think of. But what about politically or in geopolitical terms? You know, is that era gone as well, when maybe global leaders had one too many and, you know, did something that they came to regret, not on the personal level, but on the meta level?
Well, I mean, I was hoping to find, you know, the great scoop where a very important decision was taken drunk. I didn't. I mean, I certainly think it had a role to play in decision making, even as recently as the coalition government here in the UK. I talked to Nick Clegg, who said that, you know, every so often, every few months, that the quad, the core four ministers in the coalition government would sit down and have a dinner. No advisors, no civil servants, just the four of them in David Cameron's office, in David Cameron's flat. And there'd be a bottle of wine on the table. And he said, look, we would have made our decisions anyway. We would have talked candidly about what the government should be doing. But he was certain that the alcohol helped. Mm. It just, you know, it unknotted them. It softened the atmosphere. Boris Johnson, the new foreign secretary, I mean, he told me that when he was mayor of London, going around the world trying to do deals with the Chinese, great big vats of Margaux were consumed. And that helped, in his view, bring business into London. Now, Boris Johnson, we mentioned Nigel Farage. Boris Johnson is another, you know, celebratory drinker. He thinks it's a crucial ingredient in politics. I mean, he concedes that it is, in his words, a treacherous friend, and you've got to be careful about it.
But a friend nonetheless.
It's a friend to the politician nonetheless, and he certainly, as our new foreign secretary, will, I think, be deploying it in his diplomacy. But in terms of big decisions, I mean, there is the story of Richard Nixon, who was an unhappy, maudlin, angry drinker. Didn't take much to set him off. He apparently ordered a tactical nuclear strike on North Korea in 1969, I think it was, after a very heavy session. But luckily for all of us, people around him intervened and stopped it happening.
That's pretty bad. That's quite extreme. Worse than a hangover, one might say.
Most people get to eat a kebab and regret it. Exactly. Other people get to press the nuclear button. Well, thank you so much. That was Ben Wright, and he is the author of Order, Order, The Rise and Fall of Political Drinking.
Andrew, we should maybe play some music. Let's have some musical accompaniment. Not a waltz, as I've that politician's name escaped me. He tried to...
Let's have a snorterino.
Yeah, snorterino, that's what we need. This is new from Jen Champion, who you may have heard recording in the past, under monikers S and Jen Ghetto. But this is her, Jen Champion, with No One.
Well, that was Jen Champion with a winning song called No One. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly.
How much information can you pack into a minute? Every morning, the Monocle Minute wings its way into your inbox, packed with the very latest news and views from around the world, all delivered with a monocle twist. We'll tell you what that new aircraft carrier means for Southeast Asia, why the next EU summit will be more interesting than normal, and what to look out for at an upcoming election. We'll pick out the latest retail trend in Latin America, analyse the aviation news in Australia, and take a tour of a neighbourhood that's on the up. And there's more. At the weekend, we'll review the best new restaurants, give you the lowdown on that art exhibition you've been meaning to visit, and dissect the best of the latest fashion week. See? There's rather a lot you can pack into a minute. Sign up now at monocle.com/minute.
Being a pop star seems like a dazzling, lavish lifestyle, right? But have you ever wondered how your favourite pop song was written?
I do a lot of writing in the bath with my housemate sat on the toilet taking a photo.
Or who that song was really intended for.
Writing love songs in Spanish, I could say really pathetic, sad things, and it would be a secret from the audience and also from the person that I was writing about.
Join us on The Sessions at Midori House each week, where we bring in a wealth of musical talent to perform live for us and reveal a few truths about making music and keeping your ego under control. Well, sometimes.
I'm unconsciously comparing myself like a jackass to Paul McCartney.
From electropop to indie rock and with plenty of soul to boot, tune into The Sessions at Midori House every Saturday at 8:15 London time for lessons in stardom and a soundtrack to kickstart your weekend.
Dominic Wilcox works between the worlds of art, design, craft and technology. Some might call him an artist, others an inventor. But what he does certainly isn't done by many others. Architect Thomas Heatherwick has described Wilcox's ideas as serious challenges to the real world to keep looking at itself with innocent eyes, wondering what else is possible.
And this week, he's contributed work to a new contemporary art exhibition in London created specifically to be enjoyed by dogs. The Playmore exhibition at the Hub on Tanner Street is the world's first of its kind for man's best friend, and it follows Dominic's other recent works, such as the Inventors event, in which he asked children to create inventions and then asked makers to make the best ones. These included the War Avoider, the Family Scooter, Creakless Slippers, and a Pringles Hook. He joins us now to tell us about art not for kids but for dogs and how to keep in touch with our creative side more broadly. Dominic, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Great to have you with us. Now tell me, I'm a dog enthusiast, as is Andrew. I presume that you are as well. What's the starting point then for a doggy exhibition?
Well, I mean, I did have a dog many years ago called Paddy. He was a greyhound, and it was found on the street, set out by an ex-greyhound racing owner. And we tracked it down. It was Irish because it has a little yellow green number in its ear. And I loved Paddy. So gentle. He was a bit like me. But
I wonder what the green tag in your ear was.
The reason why I say that is that I did a lot of athletics, and then I left for university, and my dad took
Pushed
Paddy
on the
as the improvement on me, in fact. So that's my sort of doggy history. But yeah, then I got this request, as I tend to attract these unusual requests, and this was from more than Pettinschuvens, and they said, would you be interested in creating the world's first contemporary art gallery exhibition for dogs, not for humans, not about dogs, but for dogs? And of course I found that hilarious and fascinating and a good challenge.
And it's led to numerous pieces of exhibition work, including something that's going to simulate being in the back of a car with the wind blowing in your face, which dogs love. So what is this? Is it like a giant hairdryer that's going to be placed in the gallery?
Yeah, this one is a giant 2D cutout of a car with three window holes cut out. Then behind there is three raised plinths with three dog baskets on, so the dogs can sit in there, stick the head through this window.
Then I've got a giant fan. It's a 32-inch wide fan. But we've increased the size of the cage of the fan and put shelving in so I can put about 7 different smelly items. The reason for this is that the reason why dogs stick their head out of car windows isn't just to enjoy the view. It's actually because they get a blast of thousands of scents into their super sensitive nose. And so we're going to blow these smells, roast chicken, flowers, smelly socks.
Are you supplying the socks?
Yeah, I'm working on that. I'm still working on this. And then also we've made this mechanical landscape that's going to be hand rotated, that goes on a loop. Basically, I took a photograph of the park and blew it up and spread it around on a loop. And so that's going to really bring the thing to life.
So when you come to the exhibition, you can bring your dog with you, obviously. And is there a kind of a limit on how many? Because not all dogs get on with each other. Are you kind of worried about how many dogs are going to turn yes. up at one time?
Yes, it's been thought about, that issue. So I think, yeah, it's going to be staggered. It's going to be staggered to a certain amount at this.
Big dogs in the evening, small dogs. Because maybe you should have the thing that have like, kind of Disney things where there's like a height thing. You're only suitable to go on this ride if you're at a certain height.
Yeah. Well, actually, for the car, I've built different height plinths. To cater for the big dogs and the small dogs to get the head through the window.
It's very, very inclusive. And what else have we got? Because it is interesting that idea, I'm sure dog owners, as Andrew says, will be familiar with that idea of dogs loving that kind of amazing smorgasbord of smells that barrages their senses in the car. And there's other things, I guess, these truisms about dogs. They love doggy treats. They love, chasing a ball. And you've managed to kind of integrate a lot of these things, these staples of the doggy, interest zone into some of the other pieces as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, the first thing you do is you think about, so what does interest a dog? I try to get into the dog's mind. If they went to an art exhibition, what exactly would they enjoy? What would be challenging to a dog? Can we mentally challenge the dog? So basically, I looked at the sort of the things that we know. So they love balls, love playing with loads of balls. So I've got this giant dog ball. It's 3 meters wide. Dogs love food. They love playing with balls. I'm combining it. And I've seen that, dogs love those play ball pits, the children's multicoloured. Yeah. But I decided to do a dog ball version. So I actually created some brown play ball balls, which are ultra rare. In fact, you can't get brown play ball balls, I discovered. So I actually created these especially. So, yeah, so that's a big giant ball pit food ball to play around.
And have you tested these out on any dogs yet, or is this still kind of like work in the studio? And I'm just concerned that when the dog sees it, it doesn't go, oh my god, that's a big dog bowl, I'm a bit scared of that big dog bowl.
Yes, well, it is a bit of improvisation, and each dog has its own personality. Some are more confident than others.
So you haven't run a little sort of doggy focus group to test out?
No, I have seen videos of dogs jumping in some tiny little ball pit, so that was good enough for me.
Okay. Good stuff. I know there's also some, I guess these are quite experimental installations, as you've described them, but there are paintings and drawings as well. But even these are very specifically tailored for the dog's eye view on the world.
Yes. So I thought it would be good for me to curate and commission 6 artists to do some wall-based work. So painting, drawing, collage, photography, with the sort of brief to that these will be for dogs to view and interpret. And, but I thought we'll show them at dog eye level, so low on the wall. Also, the colours should be in colours that only dogs can see, which turns out to be yellows and blues mostly, and greys and browns. And also, we're going to scent each of the artworks depending on what the subject matter of each artwork was. So there's a lot of thought into it. I know it's a crazy sort of premise, but I am taking it seriously, as I do everything, really.
So Dominic, you went to the Royal College of Art. You've made all these incredible inventions. I can understand how they happen as events.
How do you pay the bills at the end of the month? how do you look after yourself? Do you think of yourself as an artist? Do you sell these pieces on? Do they have other lives? How do you fill out the bank balance of Dominic?
Yeah, I mean, it's a mixture of different things. So I do sell things. I've got a book of invention drawings, variations on normal, and I get commissions from either organisations or local councils or brands, basically to do something interesting on a particular theme. So I quite like challenges, and I can do things that people seem to enjoy.
And were you surprised when you sound like somebody who could have gone to do a science degree or could have done an arts degree. You seem, to straddle both sides of the academic world. Mm. When you were young, did you think, well, maybe I'll be a scientist or maybe I'll be a technician or maybe I'll be an artist? How come you ended up on the art route?
I say at school, I was sort of an average, typical A-level art painting standard. And I thought, my dad wanted us to go to Nissan, but I said, no, Dad, it's a bit like Billy Elliot. No, it's not as bad as that. But I said, no, Dad, I'm going to the Art and Design Foundation course at Sunderland University in the Northeast. But on there, I was drifting along, and then there was this guy called Charlie Holmes, and he was in the graphic section, and he was a contemporary artist, and he took us to contemporary art galleries, and he set us briefs and challenges to come up with ideas based on, ideas. So at school, I hadn't really thought of art as a thing of ideas. It was more just painting things. So he really opened up my mind, because I did them, and I realised I could do them well, and I've been doing it ever since. But I then went to Edinburgh College of Art, did visual communication, sort of graphic design. So I went down that 2D route. And then I went to the Royal College, which was design products. I just saw a documentary on BBC Two about this course called Design Products, led by Ron Arid at the time. And there was an artist on there. And I thought, and it was very much conceptual and ideas. So I've sort of come through design education, but really with a very conceptual approach to it. So I suppose that's why... It could be art, could be design, but with crafting, and it's a combination of things. And I use technology sometimes because I think technology is a bit like magic. Well, it is like it's the modern magic. So yes, it's a sort of combination. But all I'm really interested in is creating interesting, innovative, surprising, thought-provoking, provocative objects that excite me in a way. And if it can excite me, I presume there'll be other people might be interested. So it's really, that's the way it is.
And Dominic, just tell me, we've had some fun with you today, but it sounds like there's two interesting things, I guess, that you're connecting with everything from dogs to kids to people who feel a little bit on the edge of the design world in many senses. And although these things are fun and entertaining, behind quite a few of the things, it sounds as though there's a little bit of a serious message as well. One of the devices you've made is a pre-handshake handshake device, but it's for people who have trust issues, so it comes out as an entertaining thing and amusing, but behind it all, you're often trying to solve real problems.
I mean, I think you can raise serious issues through wit or humour or, from a sideways point rather than going at things direct. So, I mean, I'm like everybody else, I read the newspapers and I follow the news and that all feeds into my thoughts. So, this particular project is dogs, but I think you can find beauty in dogs. And,
but even then, I see that some money is being donated. If you say you guarantee to play more with your dog, some money is being donated to an animal charity here. So it sounds like even then there's an intention for people to reimagine their relationship with animals and be more caring and protective. So even then there's a nudge in the humour as well.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's important. I think, do we want to design another chair? Well, we could do that. It is true. And I'm sure there are some surprising chairs waiting to be found in the imagination. Or should we try to make the world a better place in either making people smile or making people think or making people play with their dogs for 15 minutes a day extra?
My vote goes to a, you know, video installation for a borzoi, for example.
Yeah, good,
why
good,
not?
Good for me.
Well, you can see the fruits of all of Dominic's labour. The Playmore exhibition is at the Hub on Tanner Street in London, the 19th and 20th of August, and you can get along and see it all for yourself. Dominic Wilcox, thank you very much for being with us on the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
This week, the Argentine Film Festival is taking place now in its fifth year. The event will see eight features shown between the 18th and the 21st of August across London's screens at Curzon Soho, Curzon Bloomsbury, Picture House Central and the Ritzy.
Films range from the UK premiere of director Pablo Trapero's The Clan, a gripping true crime tale, to buddy comedy Truman and Annette Katz's My Friend from the Park, which won the Sundance Special Jury Award for a screenplay. Well, joining us to tell us what cinema is saying about Argentina as a nation today is the festival's director, Sofia Serbin de Scalón. Sofia, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks very much.
Before we talk about the intricacies, I guess, of the festival, where is Argentine film at the moment? Because we hear a lot of stories about the difficulties in the country, financial often in nature, and one imagines that sometimes cultural expression can be the first thing to suffer. What kind of rude health is Argentine film in?
I think Argentine film's in great health, actually. It's gone from strength to strength. We can get into the whole history of Argentine cinema, which is quite long and intricate. But if we just take the last 5 years, which, 2016. So 2010 is when Argentina won its second Best Foreign Language Oscar for The Secret in Their Eyes. And since then, there's just been some terrific films. So we had Wild Tales, which won the BAFTA here in the UK this year for Best Foreign Language Film, which was this crazy sort of black comedy, six sort of intertwined stories about revenge. And now The Clan, which has just been kind of doing really well in Argentina. It kind of broke box office records for the biggest opening weekend when it opened. It won the Silver Lion for the director last year at Venice. So yeah, I'd say Argentine films are going through a really good moment in that we've always had really terrific directors who have been critically acclaimed on the festival circuit, at Cannes and winning prizes at Cannes and Berlin and things. But now there seems to be a really interesting mix of kind of art house auteur films that are actually kind of blockbusterish. They're appealing to mass audiences and not just Spanish speaking audiences, but international audiences. And that's really great. That's terrific.
And tell us, as Tom was saying, the country's gone from being run by de Kirchner to Macri. It feels like moving to a kind of centre ground. Does that reflect itself in the films that are coming out? Does it feel a quieter time for filmmakers? Are they not looking so much at politics now? Are they looking more at comedy and personal dramas? Have you seen the backdrop of the country's history reflected in its cinema, or does it seem to take its own route?
I think it's too soon to say how the politics will affect filmmaking, but I also think it's worth mentioning that Argentine cinema doesn't fit into one genre. It's very diverse, and the reason partly is how Argentina is made up itself. It's a country made up of people from other places. The majority of Argentines are descendant from Europeans, and that's kind of reflected in the stories that people tell and the diversity of stories. And I think that's something that whatever happens in the country politically, that's always going to happen. And, there isn't one type of filmmaking or one type of story. Like, it's not just about comedies or, if anything, it's about this kind of creativity and people just kind of really finding interesting ways to tell stories and express themselves.
And I guess one theme, and it's interesting, we sort of talk about that, the question of identity there to a degree, and family and family loyalty. And that's a theme in The Clan, which is a film you mentioned already. I know this is on show at the film festival. I think we've got a little clip. Let's just take a quick listen to this. This is director Pablo Trapero's film, The Clan.
Tranquilo, es la comida. Les reitero la suma a entregar. $1,000,000 en billetes de 100.
No puedo, papá. Que me voy a casar, papá.
¿Vos me vas a abandonar? Sos un desagradecido.
todo lo que sos lo sos gracias a mí.
Well, it certainly sounds very dramatic. Again, you have to forgive me if the nuances of the plot might be lost given my language skills, Sophia.
We can't kind of mime along to it because it's the radio.
But just tell us, I mean, bring some of that to life for our English speaking friends around the world. This is it sounds like a big thriller, noirish, very exciting.
It's very noir. It's a thriller. It's a true crime story. So basically, it's something that happened in Argentina, and it was this very respectable middle class family who, after the end of the military dictatorship, the father had been involved with the Secret Service and had presumably learned a lot of his trade from that. And he just carried on with the family business, kidnapping their wealthy neighbours for ransom and then murdering them. So it's kind of insane. But what's even crazier about it is that he got all his family involved, and they were all kind of... The main central theme in the film is the father-son relationship, because his son was a rugby star and he played for the Pumas, who's like the biggest rugby team in Argentina. And, you know, it was through his son's connections that they found victims, which is kind of very dark. And you know, that's what kind of happened, that they were kidnapping their neighbours and asking for ransom, but then they'd kill them off when the ransom was paid, so the neighbours never kind of made it home. And this is a true story, and this is what Pablo Trapero looks at in this film.
And Pablo Trapero, we should say, is going to be introducing the film, I think that's
he's
right, and some of his other work.
So really
this is
going to be
a real highlight of the whole programme.
He's coming over this year, so he's going to introduce the film at Curzon Soho on Thursday night, which is our opening, and which has sold out already. And then we've got the screening again on Friday at the Ritzy, and he's going to introduce that. And then we're also doing a special double bill of his first two features, because he's, you know, probably like one of the main voices in Argentine contemporary Argentine cinema at the moment. So we wanted him to kind of come and talk a little bit about his career. So he's going to introduce his first two features at Picture House Central on Saturday and talk about his filmmaking career. And then on Sunday we've got Carancho, which was a film that came out here a couple of years ago with the amazing Ricardo Darín. So we're going to do another screening of that as well.
Presumably now you've got your sort of, you know, systems in place. You know what makes a good festival with a good dynamic. Do you think that your curatorial eye or your director's eye is improving as years go? Do you find is it an easier process, or is it as challenging as ever?
I think it's tricky because you never know what kind of films are going to come out, and obviously, you know, sometimes you want a film and it's not available because it's been negotiated to be bought for the UK or whatever. So, you know, it's always a bit of a nervous time for me before the festival, because we obviously want to build a balanced programme of the best features. But also I'm very aware of our audience. I think, you know, our audience is made up. It's not just Argentines. It's quite a large English-speaking audience and other Latin Americans. So they're people that want to come and be entertained and want to, you know, watch something interesting, but it has to be balanced. So I try and pick films that are, you know, quality commercial, I'd say. So they have kind of an auteur feel to them, but they have a more mass appeal. And then there's always one or two, like my favourite this year is called Instant Light, and it's a beautiful black and white feature with Erica Rivers, who's the star of Wild Tales. She was the bride and the crazy bride scene at the end of Wild Tales. That's her. And she's in this. But this, you know, it's a period piece. It's in black and white. It's really atmospheric, and she does a tremendous performance. But that's not, you know, the immediate selling point of the festival. I think anything with Ricardo Darín always gets crowds in. It's just amazing how everybody wants to come and see Ricardo Darín. And people always say to me, do you have any other actors in Argentina? Because he's in every film, pretty much, that is, you know, goes out of Argentina. But no, he's great. So he's in two films this year, just to kind of make sure that everybody gets their full dose.
Exactly. It sounds very, it's a very exciting schedule. There's plenty of delights.
We've got tango as well. Enjoy. We just have to have a bit of tango.
Well, I was going to ask, is the tango quotient met? And you assure us that it is?
It's not an Argentine film festival, unfortunately, without some tango. So okay. We have tango. We actually have a tango flash mob at Picture House Central on the Sunday before the closing film, and they're going to all be dancing around Picture House Central. So people want to come along and see that and do a little free class after the performance.
Andrew, you're booking your ticket already?
Me?
I'm ready.
Well,
I'm ready.
Should,
I'm ready. To, I'm ready to
definitely
tango.
Come down there. Have a glass of Malbec.
Finally,
a tango.
Finally, he asked me.
Well, that's all happening between the 18th and the 21st of August across various London screens. You can find all the details. Sophia Serban-Skellen, who is the director of the festival. Thanks
Thank
very
you.
Much for being with us. Thank you. There we go, Andrew. Edition 371 of the Monocle Weekly passes like a rippling wave or something into the annals of history.
Into the annals?
Yeah.
Well, I'm not heading there with you, mate. I'm sticking around here.
But that was a pretty good show. Light and
Don't
shade.
Don't say it, surprised.
No. I just saying, we what did we have? We had, you know, the films, the luminous films of Argentina. We had the canine art, or art for canines, to be more accurate, and a bit of political drinking for good measure.
And a bevy at the end. What more could you want?
It was well-rounded.
Well-rounded indeed. In fact, we should tell people that at the end of September, not far off, a few weeks away now, it's already gone to print a new book about drinking and dining coming
Talk
out from
devil.
Monocle.
Absolutely.
Edited by the one and only Josh Fenner from our edits pages. That's kind of heading your way. And there are 5 more travel guides being produced as we speak. So there'll be 20 of those travel guide books by the end of the year. So
Andrew, I don't know how you do it.
And more importantly, go and buy the new issue. Treat yourself.
Exactly. On all good newsstands right now.
Exactly.
Wonderful stuff. Thanks for an order to today's Monocle Weekly team. The show was expertly produced by Tom Hall and researched by Patrick Hun and Jimena Mignan. Our studio manager today was Cassie Galpin. My thanks to them all.
Well, the Monocle Weekly is going to be back the same time next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Andrew Tuck.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Goodbye.